We have with us right-wing psychologist Chris Ferguson today.
Yes. So you can see that it's performative, but it's not nice. It's not actually empathic or caring about other individuals. It's all about the people themselves showing how moral they themselves are. We want good bridges. We need to get the best people who can build bridges in a position of building those damn bridges. If you believe that Harvard University or Nike or the APA is a truly caring organization, then you're just dead ass wrong.
Hello and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers that built nerd culture. I'm your host, Peter Pischke, and today we have a very special guest. He's not only a rock star in the Pink Floyd tribute band Gods of Avalon, but also a psychologist and columnist for Psychology Today. And we are going to be talking about the culture of fear. Yes, Culturescape, we talk about culture, usually nerd culture, geek culture, tabletop and comics, anime and video games. But today we're going to make it a little bit different. We're going to talk about the other side of the nerds, and that is the science nerds. And what we have been seeing in the universities and institutions that's put a lot of people on edge. With this terrible massacre on October 7th, it is worth discussing what is happening in the universities. And to give my audience a sense of bearing, I'm bringing with me one of the most well-spoken, thoughtful guys that are in academia that talk about academia around. And Chris Ferguson is definitely one of those. And I know many of you have been feeling it. It seems like every institution is becoming more political and ugly in increasing ways, whether it's Harvard and Yale pushing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, the AMA pushing all kinds of nonsense, the teachers unions and many school districts now putting out statements against reading math standards. It feels like the world is on fire and it makes no sense. So today we're going to go into why is this happening? What are the dynamics at play? What needs to happen for things to change? And what does Chris think about Ghostbusters? Yes, that is one of my favorite film franchises, as many of you know. I want to know what he thinks. All right, Chris, let's get started.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the good news, I don't think everybody's lost their mind. It's just the people that get the most attention are the people that lost their mind, unfortunately. You know, and what I think was happening, you know, at a lot of academic institutions, whether that's universities or places like the AMA or the American Psychological Association or places like that, is that they've increasingly become run more by what you might think of as like technocrats, you know, just kind of people that bureaucrats, you know, that just want to kind of keep their job. And their constituents or their loudest constituents end up being these highly progressive, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but these kind of like really far left, very vocal individuals who really sort of buy into these kind of grievance politics. And they've used a very effective line of argumentation that you need to do this thing or you're racist or you're transphobic or you're sexist or whatever it may be. And all these things are taboos in American society, right? To be racist is a taboo, you know, to be sexist is a taboo. We're not supposed to be these things. So they've really managed to sort of leverage these types of arguments and get these institutions to do very stupid things, you know, in some respects. So, I mean, I can tell you, like, everybody thinks about, like, the highly woke, you know, young Gen Z, sort of like the stereotype of Gen Z folks. And, yeah, obviously the people that are running the AMA are not that. You know, I mean, they're in their 60s, you know, they're Gen Xers for the most part, maybe even some boomers still. But they're cowards is what they are, you know? So, you know, essentially that they're responding to the loudest voices in their constituency and doing so badly, both because there's not a counter voice, you know, there's not another side, or there hasn't been another side that sort of argued against that very effectively. And they're afraid of losing their jobs, you know, essentially. Yeah, you know, they're sort of giving into these types of moral narratives because they, you know, which I understand, they have a family to feed and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, we've seen this in some situations where, you know, I think it was Peter Bonilla, is that the teacher who even like recorded his principal, that the principal on the recording even said, like, I don't really believe this. you know, but I have to do it, you know, because it's what the kids want, or whatever the teachers want, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I think on the political left, there's just been this like incredible moral aggression, if you will, that has forced a lot of, you know, people into these positions that look really, really bad to the vast majority, because the vast majority don't really have a constituency in these institutions, you know, essentially. So I think that's what happened with these, with the universities. But what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years is these universities have made statement after statement on Black Lives Matters, Ukraine, Roe v. Wade or Dobbs, or, you know, and then all of a sudden 1,400 Jews are massacred and they can't find their voice, you know, all of a sudden institutional neutrality, they discover this, you know, and it's just terrible look, right? You know, all of a sudden the one thing you can't, you know, condemn is, you know, something we've all been taught is terrible, which is the massacre of Jews, right? You know, and yeah, so it's a really terrible look, you know, and they're doing it again because they're afraid of this political, this very far left political, you know, group, which maybe is 8% of students, you know, I mean, it's not, or maybe a little higher. It's not the majority of students, but they're the most vocal students who will go on Twitter and create a Twitter mob, or will, you know, end up protesting on the news or something like that. So they're really trying, they found themselves, all these institutions, you know, essentially, you know, extorted by or pressured by this relatively small number of highly vocal activists, and they haven't figured out a strategy of how to deal with them other than to capitulate.
You bring up a good point that this is seen more in the technical sides of society. So no one is saying, you know, I want to go work the trucking job, and then you have to sign the colonial statement. Oh, you know, our trucking depot was built on Cherokee land. You don't have to do that if you're a trucker. If you're going to plumbing school, no one asking, okay, keep giving me your pronouns, Joe, before we're going to teach you how to use the wrench. That's not happening. It's happening in the technocracy. So it's really bizarre, though, from my standpoint, because I talked to a lot of people who either teach a medical school or have attended medical school. And that's when I first really noticed it, because it wasn't just like the humanities. It wasn't just like the sideshow that, you know, the university, at least all my life, you know, most of the 20th century has been very left wing. It was something really that went beyond that, where I'm talking to people who teach in medical schools and are like, look, if you want to be here, you have to sign on to all these things, and you have to shut up, and you have to even push down dissent. I've talked to students who say, what seems to matter at this point, I mean, I still have to do all the hard work, you know, study, do the homework, but the emphasis, if you want to get ahead, if you want to get accolades, is you have to play all the right political cards. You have to be against colonialism, you have to be against racism, you have to be against, I mean, you name it, they're doing it. And it seems like the people who matter. So it doesn't really matter if Joe the plumber, if he's like, oh, I, you know, before I work on your clogged sink, I need to tell you about your privilege. That would be annoying, but it doesn't hurt anything. The problem is, if you're going to medical school and the people who are graduating, and this is the thing that I hear all the time, people tell me, but they're not allowed to say out loud. Like, no, don't say this. Don't write this down. Don't put this anywhere.
Yeah.
But this is how I think, is that there's a fear that we're pushing these things to the point where it is affecting and will have a future impact on the quality of people from these institutions. So the medical school student who graduates today, and they got ahead of the other student because they knew how to write the best essay about the history of white privilege, that's not the person you want necessarily doing surgery on you. But the system is set up in such a way, and what's happening right now is that is what's pulling people ahead. And there is this worry at the moment that we're going to see further degradation of institutions and further real world consequences in a way I don't think we've seen so far.
Right. Yeah. I mean, anyway, listen, who do you want to build your bridge, right? You know, the person that got the highest SAT score, or the person who was able to talk about, like, how they overcame adversity, you know, kind of thing. You know, I want my bridge. I don't care if the person who built this black, white, Asian, as long as they're smart, right? And they know how to build a bridge. That's what we should be, you know, looking at. I mean, but what's happening, you know, at universities and also, you know, medical schools, and you hear all this talk about dropping standardized exams, right? You know, so a lot of universities have dropped the SATs or the ACTs. You know, a lot of grad schools are dropping the GREs. I don't know if medical schools have, you know, any have dropped the MCAT yet, but, you know, I think the person talked about, you know, that possibility. And they do so because, you know, there are these group differences, right? You know, that typically, I mean, anybody can, you know, if I gave you different ethnic groups, anybody could probably figure out where they sort, you know. So you talk about, like, you know, Jewish Americans, Black Americans, Asian Americans, you know, American Indians, Latinos, and whites, you know, kind of these six broad groups. You know, just Asians score highest, you know, Jews score second, you know, whites are right in the middle, Latinos right behind whites, and then, you know, Native Americans and Black Americans tend to score the lowest. So people look at those scores, and, you know, rather than saying, well, maybe it's because, you know, the groups on the bottom tend to have more poverty, we should address that in order to try to fix things, they just don't like the test, right? You know, so we're just going to get rid of we're just going to scrap the test and have people write essays or look at other things. But unfortunately, the tests work very well, right? The tests actually do, you know, predict, you know, academic achievement, performance in, you know, high intellectual careers like engineering or medicine or things like that. Whereas being able to write an essay, first off, a lot of these people aren't going to actually write the essay. They're going to hire somebody else to write it for them. And essay writing, if anything, if you're talking about, like, unfair, the opportunity to train people out or get coaches and this kind of stuff is more inequitable than the SATs or the GREs. You know, I mean, sometimes there are fair, you know, comments about, well, maybe rich people can hire tutors for the GRE or the SAT or things like that. That's fair, you know, as a criticism, but that's certainly also true for the, you know, essays. And again, whether you can write, because the pressure is now going to be the sense of, like, finding some element of your, you know, I'm Irish American, so I'm going to write about, like, my grandparents, you know, in the Depression, you know, with Irish need not apply signs and how somehow that related to my life, which is going to be an incredible stretch, to be honest with you, you know. But that's what people are going to feel pressured to do now, is to come up with that narrative over and over and over and over again in order to sort of win at this kind of, like, adversity Olympics, you know, kind of thing. And there's really no evidence whatsoever that your ability to do this, you know, or to hire somebody to do it for you, is in any way predictive of your ability to build a bridge or to take out, you know, a tumor from a sick person or whatever else that we're interested in these people doing. So, you know, it is an unfortunate turn away from meritocracy, which we could say, like, you know, the U.S. and other sides are not perfectly, you know, meritocratic, but the other alternative is definitely garbage. So we're going to end up with much worse outcomes rather than fixing the margins of a meritocracy. So I think those concerns are legitimate, that you're going to start selecting people for advanced careers based upon the view that they've overcome or their ability to write an essay, claiming, in many cases probably falsely, that you have overcome adversity. You're going to get much worse outcomes from that pool of applicants than you are if you have some kind of standardized quantitative exam that is predictive of actual academic outcomes, which things like the SAT, the GRE, the MCAT, the LSAT all actually do. So it isn't a great turn. Again, but a lot of what's happening in these last few years is not really rational. It's all about this sort of performative morality, you know, groups that are trying to, you know, none of these companies that I've talked about, like, you know, land acknowledgements, like, you know, this building is built on land that used to belong to the Seminoles. Yeah, they're not going to give it back. It's just, yeah. You know,
it doesn't, like, okay, and now you have to make a donation to the nearest reservation charity. No, that isn't usually part of
that. I mean, I don't think they do that. I think they just say this thing. And what they don't tell you is that, well, the Seminole took it from some other tribe before they did. Yep. You know, Native Americans don't start their speeches with, hey, you know, our reservation was, we had some land taken from us, but we also took land from this other tribe. The English don't start their thoughts saying this used to be Celtic land, you know, before they took it. You know, it's very selective and very performative. And, you know, even these companies that you're saying, like, you know, whatever it's Microsoft or Google or Apple or, you know, Nike or things like that. And they say, well, you know, Black Lives Matter, put the little square on their Instagram, this kind of stuff. But they're, like, you know, they're using slave labor in China to build the stuff that they build. Their actual treatment of human beings is atrocious. But this sort of stuff that they do by supporting whatever the latest progressive cause may be is all about, you know, sort of performative, look at us, we're so good, we're little angels. but their actual behavior is atrocious, you know, in terms of how they treat other people. And I think you can kind of see this with, and that's what came out last month, I think, that made this really, really clear, is you all was talking about support minority groups, words are violence, watch out for microaggressions, and all of a sudden, 1,400 dead Jews, meh. All of a sudden, context matters, whatever the hell that means. So you can see that, you know, this is performative, but it's not nice. You know what I mean? It's not actually empathic or caring about other individuals. It's all about the people themselves showing how moral they themselves are.
It's a culture of selfishness and ignorance. I think one of the craziest things I'm seeing right now is the teachers unions are joining the chorus of, we have to get rid of math testing. We have to get rid of anything that might put out an unequal outcome. So there's like, that could start at the math and science standard. But under that rubric, that could conclude anything in education. I mean, it's not all bad. Like, I'm starting to see people finally say, like, why is it when someone wants to enter an elite college, they have to look at, oh, you played lacrosse for 5 years. Oh, you went on a mission trip to the Uruguay. Like, why does any of that matter if I'm trying to go to school, you know, to become a chemist? It really should. So it's not like this is all bad. Some of these ideas or these thinking, there are some positives to it. Like, if they're thinking, okay, what is getting in the way of these students getting ahead? Fine. But generally, it seems like the way that they are dealing with it is that they're just going to pull up the ladder behind them. They're going to pull up the rug. Oh, you have a problem with this rug? Whoop, rug gone, problem fixed.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it, I think, is, you know, with like the standardized testing, you know, like math testing or reading testing in schools, I suspect is the sense of like the numbers are embarrassing. That first of all, the numbers all across the board aren't great. But also, if you do see these kind of disparate outcomes that, you know, certain, like the Asian kids do better than everybody else, and kids from like Black or Native American backgrounds don't do as well as the other kids do or whatever, you know, that's embarrassing, right? You know, nobody's happy about that. So you just get rid of the test, you know, and then poof, it all goes away, right? You know, then you don't have those embarrassing numbers, you know, anymore. So if you get rid of those, and I think that's a lot of what like universities are doing by getting rid of the SATs, is now you don't have those sort of that sense of we're adjusting standards for minority kids versus like white or Asian kids, which is, you know, was the root of the recent Supreme Court case, you know, that struck down affirmative action, you know, at universities, you know, so. I think there's a certain like kill the messenger effect, but I agree with you. I mean, there were other like stupid ways of like bringing people into like, I like the legacy admissions. I mean, I'm all for this idea of like, just because your dad's rich and built a building, you know, for a university, I don't think that his kids should get it. You know, it's a nice thing to do, but yeah, you know, but what they're doing is they're really just sort of selling spots at a university that rich people that can donate a lot of money can get their kids in kind of automatically. You know, I'm all for getting rid of that. I think that is absolutely an unfair advantage. And maybe that does advantage whites more than other groups or whatever. I'm still fine with getting rid of that. The problem is not that the system is a perfect meritocracy and we shouldn't do anything. I think there are some legitimate criticisms of some of these things where it's not meritocratic and we should fix that, like by getting rid of legacy admissions. You know, possibly, as you say, getting rid of some like, you know, sports favoritism, although that'll be difficult for the schools that make a ton of money off of it.
The big school around here is University of Nebraska, state over. Huskers are huge, like all the states surrounding it. And if that they lost that kind of privilege, I think everyone in Omaha would just lose their minds.
Yeah. And it would be same in Florida. I mean, like, you know, UF, FSU, even UCF right down the street from me are all kind of big, you know, football schools and that kind of stuff. So they wouldn't be happy losing that opportunity. But you're right. I mean, there is a sense of like, well, what is a university for? And maybe there's some fair criticism that it's become more of like a credential, right? The sense of like to get any kind of like a mid-level drone position in society, you have to have this kind of stupid credential that it's not really required for the job. So maybe we're oversending people to universities anyway. But if we're going to send people, it should be the people that intellectually have the best ability to succeed in that institution, you know, and that should be the end of it. Now, that means we send a lot more Asian kids to universities than we send a lot more Asian kids to universities because they're the ones that, for whatever reason, have prepared, you know, for universities. And if other groups, including whites, don't like that, then we need to think about, well, what do we need to do as parents, you know, or as a culturally, you know, in order to achieve at the same level, not shoot them down by saying that they don't have nice personalities, or they're not kind, or whatever the hell it was that Harvard did to them in order to prevent a lot of them from going. Again, you know, if we want good bridges, we need to get the best people who can build bridges into the position of building those damn bridges, you know, and whether they say that someone microaggressed against them in the past or something like that isn't really going to tell us anything about whether they can build a bridge or not. But yeah.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, this is a culture show. And I think the theme of this is a culture of fear and its knock-on effects and its direct effects. Knock-on effects is what's going to happen to the future. You know, these institutions feed very important parts of society and politics, law, science, medicine, you know, where you do need the technocrats, where you need the kind of person that has expertise, you know, someone like you. And it's very important they actually know how to do their job. Getting ahead because you could say all the right things, and it's less about ability. And I know that's a hard conversation for some people to have or think about. That does cause future problems down the road. The other problem is when this happens, it seems like these institutions, they get apathetic about their moral responsibilities. In point, the AMA, there are so many things that the American Medical Association needs to work on. Say it's any of the stuff even that I cover. The opioid crisis, pain patients losing access, cancer patients losing access. Well, the AMA is spending all this time about talking about white heteronormativity. That's less time they're spending on dealing with the issue with cancer patients not getting enough pain control. And that's them, you know, they're taking what they're supposed to do and they're taking that opportunity cost and they're flipping it over for the, I hate to use this word. I'm trying not to use this word very much, but woke, you know, the woke thing to do. And yeah. It's like, okay, you've done that, but now what about, you know, Gail, who's third stage lung cancer in the hospital? She's dying, and her doctor says, well, I can't give you the pain meds because I don't want to get in trouble. You know, that's your problem, AMA. Like, anyone can complain about racism. Literally everyone is. Someone else could do that. You got to do the cancer thing, but you can't have that conversation because all this is just all one giant blob of isms. And that worries me because I think, okay, I'm seeing it only from my perspective on this little thing. How many little things across the country is this happening to? Like, where else are there things that need to be covered that are not being covered because they're now worried about heteronormativity, colonialism, you know, the white patriarchy? You name it, they're doing it, and it leaves me. And I don't think I'm alone in this. It leaves me kind of concerned.
Yeah. They made a statement on everything but the degree to which the exorbitant salaries doctors have contribute to high healthcare costs in the United States, right? You know?
Yeah. No, we don't like them. Quiet.
Well, I mean, it's the funny thing. I mean, you can even think of like, well, I mean, they don't have to be conservatives, right? They could even like address real progressive causes, like say some kind of improving healthcare, whether it's universal healthcare or at least just bringing costs down for people. So white coats for black lives, whatever, right? You know, they're all like having die-ins and this kind of thing. What they don't talk about is like, well, it's pretty damn expensive to get medical care if you're in a poor community, right? You know, so what are you guys going to do about that? Well, crickets, you know, nothing, you know, because you have to figure out some way of bringing drug costs down, surgery costs down, all this stuff. We all know that Americans on average pay more for this stuff than even other industrialized democracies. Part of that, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. It's a complicated problem. We don't have to go down that rabbit hole, but part of it is doctor salaries. They make a lot more money here than they do like in the UK. So, I mean, you can fix that because you're the doctors, right? You're the organization that represents doctors. So you could talk about that. We make too much money. We're so sorry. We would like to make less money so that, you know, poor people can get more medicine and that sort of stuff. So you could tackle that. But no, it's going to be, like you said, the heteronormativity or whatever. Like, that's like the world's biggest problem at the moment. If you're a poor, struggling coal miner in West Virginia, that your big problem in life is colonization or something of that sort, you know. No, it's really not like a pressing problem for the median person. Even the median poor person is not worried about, like, you know, post-colonialism or land acknowledgments or whether orcs are evil in Dungeons and Dragons, you know, or all these kind of like silly things that, you know, we're seeing people take positions on at this point. They want, you know, they want more money, you know, and they want to have access to healthcare and food. And they don't want like leaking oil drums in the backyard and all this kind of stuff. If you really want to help these communities, those are the kind of things you want to address. Not, heteronormativity or the patriarchy or any of these other kind of like weird things that none of these organizations are really woke. That's the reality. They're all in it for their own empire, if you will, including academia. They're preserving their own piece of the pie, so a lot of it is like, look at what this hand's doing so you don't see what this other hand is doing down here. And that's that performative nature of a lot of these things. If you believe that Harvard University or Nike or the APA is a truly caring organization, then you're just dead ass wrong. The APA in Black Lives Matter, that whole like in COVID, all that kind of stuff, all the stuff about social justice. At the same time, they laid off, I think, like a whole bunch of their low ranking employees. They gave their executives raises at the same time. That's the opposite of social justice, right? I mean, that's rich people stuffing their own pockets. It's a classic example of an organization that talks the talk about social justice, but their actual behavior with their actual employees is the opposite of that thing. The people at the top are always going to come out ahead, and they're just going to say or do whatever they need to do in order to do that. Now, they could make a lot of noise about conservative values, or they can make a lot of noise about progressive values, but they're just basically human beings doing what human beings always do, which is to be selfish and to try to hoard as much stuff for yourself.
Have you seen it in your career? Because you've done plenty of scientific research. You've done like violence on video games. You did a ton of work on that. That's really interesting. Are you starting to see any of these effects in the world of science and trying to put together studies and covering certain topics? Because I know, at least from the medical field, anything that seems to be approaching the trans issue, a lot of it is getting stuffed down. It's like, no, quiet, don't talk about this. Are you seeing any of that? Because I do have concerns, because I feel like these institutions, especially science or medicine, where you do need these long form analysis, that's so important. You see more and more of these things saying, "Hey, you're not allowed to say that, or you're not allowed to cover it." It does leave me worried. Do you see any of that, or is that just overblown, at least in your area?
No, absolutely. I mean, the example you mentioned is a perfect example of this, where you see a lot of like trans medicine and this kind of thing, right? And it's not an area I'm an expert in by any means, but you certainly do see this kind of really poor quality studies come out. They get hyped by the news media because they kind of fit the sort of narrative. I don't have a real strong opinion one way or the other on this issue, just to be very upfront with it. But you do definitely see this, the sense of the science is supposed to say something that supports this kind of like progressive narrative. And where I can tell you that where it is actually in my realm that I know very clearly is, if you think about like social media, right? People talk about social media having, maybe causing mental health problems for young people. And of course, gender dysphoria would be an example of a mental health problem, right? So you do see like tons and hundreds of studies that sort of broadly look at social media effects on mental health. Though I'm not convinced that there's any real evidence. It's just social media does cause problems with mental health. I don't think the evidence is there, but you see all these, literally hundreds of studies that, look in some way at social media use and mental health. And the number of studies look at social media and gender dysphoria is exactly zero. Even though this gets brought up in books, it gets brought up in debates. Abigail Schreier has a pretty popular selling book about this idea that there's this like social contagion around, trans issues in girls. I'm not saying she's right. I'm not saying she's wrong. But she raises this hypothesis that social media is part of that. I've heard other people bring that up as a possibility quite regularly. And the number of scholars who want to touch that topic is zero. Because they're afraid to. Because what if you find evidence? I'm not saying, I'm sort of skeptical. I don't think you're going to find much. But what if you did? What if you provide as a probably progressive scholar evidence that social media increases people, say, trans identification, or even if it's just correlated, then it's not the correct finding, right? So I think what happens is people just don't do it because they know they don't want to find any evidence of any kind of even a correlation there. So yeah, go ahead. You guys say something.
No, I agree. And you use the word cowardice, and that describes the issue so well. It's frustrating because it feels like I keep hitting my head against a wall because I see this problem over and over, whether it's the sciences or medicine or journalism, or anything that requires people to be responsible and to say no sometimes. They just don't want to do it. Someone at some point figured out the solution to dealing with hard things is you just don't deal with it. And and it goes away magically. No one's yelling at you anymore, and you don't have to disappoint people or do anything controversial whatsoever, and everyone loves you. So someone figure that out, and then everyone said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the trouble is with, you know, a lot of these things, like, you know, these are interesting questions, right? I mean, you know, as scientists, we're supposed to be curious. That people have raised this question, you know, does social media cause gender identity issues? I don't know that it does or doesn't, but it's an interesting question, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think whatever answer you find is fascinating, right? If you find that there's no effect, and that kind of fits my priors, you know, but that's interesting. Yeah, I'm right, right? You know, but on the other hand, if you do find an effect, that's still fascinating. That's interesting, you know, and... You know, screw my priors. You know, I want to know what the truth is. It is a shame that like some of these questions have become, you know, taboo. And I do some research on like race and policing, you know, which, you know, at least that field does have, you know, a fair number of studies that look at things like does race predict, you know, police misconduct? Are there sentencing disparities in the U.S. based upon race and things like that? And I think, you know, fortunately, I think the policing and race field is pretty good. Basically, there's not a whole hell of a lot of evidence that suggests that race is really predictive of police misconduct. There's some studies that go back and forth, to be fair. But, you know, what you see with the sentencing field, which is interesting because myself and a colleague are working on I think we're pretty close to publishing a meta-analysis of these studies. And what you see is in the studies themselves, the authors are pretty honest and say, like, you know, we don't really, you know, maybe there's a tiny difference between, say, like Latinos and whites, but there's no difference between blacks and whites. And then another study will find the inverse. And it's all just kind of this messy bunch of really, you know, nothing, you know, essentially. For the most part, you don't really see a whole lot of powerful disparities, you know, in sentencing in the U.S. criminal justice system, once you control for things like prior, you know, arrests and whatever else. But then what you see is then these scholars end up in news media and they're like, they're, you know, it's unfair, unjust, racist, Jim Crow 2.0.
Yeah, and they invariably, doesn't matter what they are, do, or say, they invariably are like, we have with us right-wing psychologist Chris Ferguson today.
Yes. I haven't voted for a conservative for president ever. But yeah, but it is true. You get these kind of things like, you know, I think probably at my university, I think somebody made the joke that, you know, that I'm the conservative on the psychology department. It's simply because
I know.
Yeah, I know. I say like you should like listen to conservative students and not tell them that they're trash. You know, I guess that's kind of like things that I've said that sort of brands me as the conservative or whatever. I'm pretty vocal about like, you know, not supporting Black Lives Matter and things like that. The organization, of course, that is to say, that's because they bought mansions with the money they get donated to them, and they stuffed their own pockets full of money, and their whole narrative about policing was wrong. So that's why, you know, the attempt is to make some sort of like database argument. Unfortunately, you know, so much of the universities, I mean, I think you still have like physics and chemistry, and most of those people still try to do their stuff. I mean, I think probably most psychologists are still trying to do some kind of good research in psychology. But you did have this kind of like wave, you know, over really like the last 60 years. I mean, it kind of went back into the 1960s, so particularly in the humanities of this sort of, I know some people call it like the grievance study, the sort of like, you know, the gender studies, the various ethnic studies and this kind of stuff that, you know, these were fields that really were never, you know, I mean, there are interesting topics, you know, so I mean, it's not that the idea is bad, but the way that these fields sort of developed was to really push for an advocacy agenda, not the truth. And for many years, I think we all just kind of like ignored them and said, well, that's nice. You know, Professor so-and-so is talking about white privilege and whatever, you know, the kids deserve to hear different viewpoints anyway. They'll hear this viewpoint and probably most of them won't take it seriously. And it's not worth it for me to like argue with this person because then I'll look bad, you know?
Yes.
And then they basically destroyed universities. I'll be upfront and say I was among the people, you know, certainly 10 years ago, I was like, I'm just not going to get into debate about white privilege, which is, you know, kind of a stupid concept, but because it's just not worth it. Now it is because universities are like on fire and a lot of it is because of these fields. You know, most students don't want to major in these things. So these departments, these fields have really outsized influence. In proportion with the research they put out that actually means anything, or the students that they teach as majors, you know, in their classes as such. But the fact that they were able to leverage these kinds of moral arguments, I mean, we see it hit its like its apex now, where you have universities and students who can't condemn Hamas, a terrorist organization that murdered 1,400 Jews, you know, and it's not to say you can't criticize the Israeli state. I think there are things that they do that are bad too, but I mean, come on, these are kids and elderly people who died. I mean, that's bad, you know, and you have like people that are educated who just can't say, well, you know what? I really feel for the Palestinian people. I'm scared that a lot of civilians are going to die in a bombing campaign, but Hamas is terrible. And those are not like mutually exclusive views that you can have, you know? So it is amazing to see, you know, universities really struggle to condemn Hamas, to condemn the murder of, you know, 1,400 Israelis, and all these students, you know, who are ripping down posters of you know, which is completely anti-free speech, and it's fine to protest, you know, on campus if you want to, but they're, you know, in some cases they're attacking Jewish students, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, you know? It's been interesting. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I've seen so many people in the last month, most who are moderate left-wing liberals, some that are more hardcore progressives, but so many people I've seen, the terminology is what it is, but wake up, and they're like, oh, wow. So they're not saying this part, but they're not, I wish they would say, oh, so like, those terrible people on the other side of the aisle, the right-wingers, and they said, oh, well, you know, you need to be careful who you promote and put these universities. You know, when we talk about, like, Ilhan Omar, how she spouts anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Oh, that's just a Trump talking point. And now I'm seeing more people who are realizing, like, wait a second. These people at Harvard and Yale, they're chanting, to the river, to the sea. We have this... oh, I wish it brought with me today this kind of almost moving video of this young woman who's screaming at, you know, the president of the college. And she's saying, why aren't you doing anything? These people are saying they want to kill people like me. Why aren't you doing anything? He doesn't have a response, by the way. He doesn't really respond at all. And I've seen so many people wake up and they're realizing, oh, actually, yeah, that this is happening. This is a thing that's real, that's happening now. Now, obviously, you know, all the disclaimers, most people who are Muslim obviously don't feel that way, especially in the West. Unfortunately, the kind of person that might seem to be a lot of the people that were promoted and brought into these institutions like Harvard and Yale. And so it gives me a little hope that people are waking up and they are noticing that these issues are here. But on the other side, it worries me that when we do have a few people who come out and are like, this is a big problem, we still get the heavy pushback on the other side. And so it makes me wonder if this is just them pushing out more people who might have a problem with it, or like something's actually going to change.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, I think for many of us, you know, you hit on the head, like sort of like moderate left or whatever, that's probably about where I am, you know. You know, especially in my generation, I mean, I don't know if it's different for the kids today, but, you know, we were brought up with like a history of World War II and the Holocaust, and like, you know, killing Jews is bad, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and all the stuff about, I mean, I know I'm being very simplistic about this, but, you know, it's not hard, you know, and it, probably a lot of people have seen that picture of like a Nazi rally, and there's like, you know, everybody's got their hand raised, right? You know, and there's the one guy who's sitting there, you know, with his arms folded. And, you know, the narrative is like, you know, everybody thinks they're going to be that one guy, right? They're going to be the guy who's going to resist hate, right? You know, and now you know if you're that one guy or not, right? If you're chanting from the river to the sea, you know, maybe there's like, and I understand maybe there's some complexities in the background of that phrase, in fairness, but we know that's being used by Hamas now to reference, you know, the annihilation of Jews in Palestine, right? You know, this whole area. So, you know, it is being used to advocate for, you know, for genocide. And I think what happened in the institutions is, you know, a lot of the dialogue, the narrative, used kind of like euphemisms, like decolonialization, right? It's kind of this thing. Like my friend Wilford Riley, who's a criminal justice professor in Kentucky, I think he put it best, like, decolonization is basically ethnic cleansing, but woke. You know, essentially, like, if you kind of think of like the implications of what decolonization, everybody thinks it's like, oh, we're going to like take a few like white people books out of the library, put some people in from like novels from Africa, which actually would be fine. There's nothing bad about that. But now we're seeing the sense of like, no, people have said like, you know, they felt Lewis said, what did you think decolonization meant after 1,400 Jews got killed? This is before the bombing campaign. You know, yep. you can criticize the Israeli bombing campaign you want. This came before any the Israelis reacted in any way, you know, shape or form. So you have people that are, you know, on the political left, essentially cheering on the murder of 1,400, you know, Jews. And that's like, holy shit. I mean, this is like, you know, we were clearly raised to identify this as being bad. You know, again, it's not to say you have to give the Israeli state carte blanche to do anything. Some of the things they're doing in the West Bank, you know, I don't agree with. But just murdering civilians is a horrible thing. So I think there is this, you know, holy crap, this does look a lot like, you know, 1933 Germany a little bit. You know, I know people make that kind of comparison, like, you know, way too much. And, you know, I don't want to go down that, you know, that
rabbit hole. Far, yeah.
But, you know, but it certainly is stuff that, you know, it should have, we thought it was taboo. To get up in Sydney in front of the Opera House and chant the Jews, you know, and this kind of stuff. Like, what the hell happened that this that people are just doing this on camera? But I think, you know, to your question, you're kind of like, you know, it's just going to like result in any kind of reformation. I don't know. And you know, I think that if you kind of like think of this as dominoes, I mean, if you think of like from 2020 to 2023, things have gotten a little bit better, right? You know, we see some people are sort of like backing away from, you know, peak wokeness. Again, to use that word, I know you don't want to use it too much, but, you know, so things have gotten a little bit better over these last 3 years. But if some people have gotten optimistic, I've seen some essays written saying like, this is starting to get better, it's eventually going to go away. And if that is true, I'm not saying it's definitely true, but if that is true, and you think of like different groups or like dominoes, like maybe the politicians, like, you know, the Democrat Party will come to its senses and keep, you know, electing people like Joe Biden, who's reasonably moderate, you know, compared to your alternatives like, you know, AOC or whatever. But you know, the last domino to fall is almost certainly going to be academia, because this was the origin point for this whole thing. It was academics that created this. It wasn't social media. Wasn't politicians. It was academia that created this problem. So I think academia is going to be the last of these dominoes to fall, if in fact there's going to be a falling of dominoes. And I think that it's going to take some degree. It's going to take a national effort. I mean, I don't think that universities individually are going to reform in any meaningful way without some kind of national or at least state by state level push. And that's not to say that I'm advocating for, so we see some states that have done it, like Texas and Florida. I'm not advocating for everything that those states are doing, you know, as some of the things the states are doing are pretty authoritarian, you know, as well, you know, so stopping people from, you know, touching on certain topics at universities or removing tenure, that kind of stuff. I don't think those are great ideas, but I do think there needs to be some kind of like national or again, at least state level. We got to bring like different stakeholders together, alumni, you know, businesses that hire college graduates, the colleges themselves, politicians from both the left and the right, kind of like, what do we really want universities to do? Because this probably isn't it, right? Whatever we're doing right now is probably not what we want universities to do. So how do we get them back to like 1989, you know, when American universities were like the pride of the world? They were producing, you know, reasonably good research. You know, they were left wing. There's no question about it, but they weren't like this, you know. And you could say, well, maybe the seeds of today were, you know, sort of in place in 1989, but at least things were much better then. You know, how do you kind of reverse this process to, you know, to get universities to be a bit more socially representative of, you know, we're always going to be stuffy elites, you know, that's not going to go away. But at least, you know, how do you get like more conservative faculty? How do you get, you know, institutions to be real supporters of free speech and intellectual curiosity? And I think it's going to take something other than relying on universities themselves to do it. I don't see a lot of appetite at the
inside institution. Yeah. The sad thing is, the number one response that I've heard especially right after when Yale and Harvard came out in such a visceral way, basically against what happened to these poor Israelis, and they were being pro-Hamas, even despite everything that was going on. Really bad luck. The number one response when they say things like to the river, to the sea, well, all they're young people, they're just ignorant. Now, put aside that these are supposed to be the cream of the crop. These are supposed to be the smartest kids in this country of 300 plus million. Putting that aside, that doesn't make it better. That actually makes it worse. It's like, okay, but these are the people who are going to populate. You know, they're going to be your judge. They're going to be your lawyer. They're going to be your doctor. They're going to be at the county clerk's office. They're going to, I mean, these are the people who are going to have control over your lives. And the fact that they are ignorant of these very important, though divisive and hard topics, it scares me. It scares me because I worry, like, what kind of people are going to be here in the future when the adults of now who you know, came from a time, you know, when you were going to school, you know, even to a degree when I was still in college in the early 2010s, where they remember, you know, we're a meritocratic society, you get ahead by being more functional and more effective. And that's going away. I don't know how we go back to that when even those people are refusing to do their jobs. And this is, you know, I apologize that so often I seem to go back to this while on Culturescape here. But, you know, this is a conversation we're having in the disability community because we have a lot of recognition, especially on social media, even the news sometimes, that there are issues that are not being handled very well. Trying to get disability it's like winning the lottery. It's just so ridiculously intense and complicated and makes zero sense that they're using standards that were created in the early 70s. I mean, like, when I went into disability, I was asked, you know, do you want to be a pillow factory worker? Because, you know, there's all those pillow factories. Do you want to be an elevator? I wouldn't be surprised if they told me, oh, by the way, what have you think about operating elevators? Like, I don't think anyone still does that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I worry because it's like with the pain stuff, it's like we're getting all these great state laws passed. We had the Supreme Court in Rouen come out in support of medical freedom. And none of it means a single thing because the people who are in charge, the politicians, the people in these institutions, if they do not enforce it, and they see this and they know that these things exist. So there are things that if we grabbed them could fix the problem, but they're refusing to pick it up. How do you get past that? That's the thing, though. It's the moral apathy. It's like, it doesn't matter what we do. If they just won't be responsible and do what they're supposed to do. And no one really wants to do that because anytime, even still, despite everything, you are that one guy in the room, you know, like James Damore over at Google, that poor moron. You speak up when you said, oh, you actually want to find out the most effective way to do it. And he believed that. But that's going to be so detrimental. We are only starting to see the negative impacts of these things. You know, I seriously worry about the institutions of the future. And you make that point about colleges. That is a great point, by the way. Pretty much everyone I know, and many even inside of academia, agree that the student loan system is just bonkers. It's totally ridiculous. It's a complete mess. It needs to change. And everyone agrees on this except the people who could actually do something about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happened across the country, across our Western culture, whether it's entertainment, comics, whether it's books, whether it's science, whether it's medicine. I don't know. What do you even do with that? I'll end my comment here before you can speak again. But someone made the great point. You know, the founding fathers believed in several principles that would keep the Constitution and the government order together. One of those principles was that people are selfish and they will jealously guard their powers, their aptitudes. So they want to, you know, I'm working for the District of Kentucky. I'm in charge of I'm on the board for, I don't know, cattle. I'm gonna protect my little cattle Kentucky thing like crazy. I'm not gonna let anyone get near it. I'm gonna be such a pain in the butt. They're gonna have to kiss the ring. That's not even happening anymore. Even the politicians are like, I don't care.
Right.
I just want to go on the news. I want to get my pay. I want to go on Ben Shapiro this week. I don't care. It's like, what do you even do with that?
Yeah.
No adults in the room.
Yeah.
Okay. Rant over. Sorry, Chris.
So I don't mean you're absolutely right. I mean that's exactly it. It's you know, people generally don't think, you know, and that's why, you know, even all these moral things, land acknowledgements, they're all goofy. They're all, you know, it's all for the individuals trying to make themselves look good. It has nothing to do with helping Native Americans or this kind of stuff, right? Yeah. So you have to understand, people mostly, I mean, there are exceptions, but people mostly do what's good for them, right? You know, so if you want to enact change, you have to either change the leadership, or you need to change the incentive structure for the people who are, you know, in leadership. So that's why I say, like, it's going to take some sort of, like, either state or national level effort if you want to change universities, you know, hopefully to function better, Then first off, you have to, you have to have some kind of like dialogue about like what, again, what do we want universities to do? And once you kind of figure out like they should like produce knowledge and be, like crucibles for, open exchange of intellectual thought, whenever we decide that that's what I would like them to do. But, whenever we decide we want them to do, well, then we'll, you're right. I mean, you say, if we want you guys to be like, free speech advocates and like produce like actual facts, not a bunch of bullshit, and they're going to nod and say, yeah, we'll do that. But they're not, right? Because it's not in their interest to do that. Why would you give people the power, to say whatever they want when you could stop them, right? And that's really more than normal human inclination. So you have to think of, well, what kind of levers do we have? And the reality is most universities take money from the federal government, I mean, both public and private universities.
Boatloads, semi-trucks full every year.
And all universities get, alumni, donations that are a big deal. Again, both public and private. All universities get, whether it's grants or other, sort of entitlements or whatever else. So those are the levers. So you kind of say, well, you need to like, really adopt like institutional neutrality. The University of Chicago's policies on institutional neutrality and free speech. And you need to like take some of these departments. And like they get a, gender studies is a perfectly reasonable field, but they need to like produce actual scholarship that's factually true on some level. We always know there's always some back and forth, but has to have some level of basic reliability or validity. If not, either you gotta, if they can't do it, then you gotta get rid of these fields. Like they're like astrology. Right, we don't have astrology departments, or intelligent design departments at universities, So if they can't manage it, then ditch them. And if they can, or if they can, reform, then keep them. And if you don't do these things, if you still are, sending out students who all they do is like have die-ins and run around with slogans, gas the Jews, or whatever the hell they're doing, or ripping down posters of kidnapped children, if that's what you're producing, then we're not going to give you. I mean, you can still exist. But we're not going to give you donations anymore, or you're not going to get research funding from the federal government. I mean, those are the kind of levers that I think that eventually we're going to have to consider. Now, of course, you have to think about, well, what about like government intrusion in these universities? How do you do this with free speech? The answer is, of course, it's a tough conundrum. But I think what you could do, and like, make this not a threat to free speech, is you don't fire anybody, but you can freeze hiring. So if you have a department, I keep picking on gender studies, I don't mean to pick on gender studies, but if you do it on like psychology, hey, this psychology department is producing garbage, right? You could freeze hiring in that department until they figure out how to hire people that do legitimate open science, pre-registered research or something like that, that is going to be less inclined to be hijacked by these moral agendas. So I mean, that is something that we'll have to kind of think about. Like, if we're going to start using state and national levers on universities, how do you do that while also balancing free speech issues? And I think that's a legitimate concern. But on the other hand, what's happening in universities right now is not free speech. And so many universities already. So we need to do something. And we did see like alumni pull their donations from Harvard and other universities this last month. University of Pennsylvania, so on and so forth, because of the inability of these universities to take any kind of stance that meant anything, on the murders in Israel. And I think that's legitimate. I think that's, the universities aren't owed this money. And if their product is poor, I work at a university. I'm not my best interest to say this stuff. I want my university to still stand 18 years from now when I retire, right? After that, I don't care. But I love being an academic. I love working at a university. So I'm not the sort of person that, is naturally inclined to criticize universities at large. But I do recognize that they're in a crisis state, right now. And something needs to be done, and I'm very pessimistic universities are going to be able to do it on their own. And they're not going to do it unless there's some kind of incentive. But we do need highly effective universities that are producing real knowledge and that are crucibles of free speech. What we have now are activist organizations that are stifling free speech. So how do we get from one to the other? We're not going to do it for reason, so we have to figure out some kind of incentive structure to get universities to, you know, reform. And I think that does need to be done on the national level.
This month, by the way, do you like Ghostbusters? Are you a fan?
But if you'd asked me in 1984, I would have said yes. I've since gone back and watched that movie and go, oh my God, it's so bad. And for me, it's one of those that did not age well. Bill Murray's character is such a jerk.
I love it. I love
it. I know. I love it.
I even love the second one. And I know the second one's terrible.
Yeah. The second one, even at the time, was terrible. But yeah. No, I loved it at the time. I loved it. And, you know, I was like, oh, I'd love to be a Ghostbuster. You know, it looked like so much fun.
I only bring it up because Parapsychology, you know, you were seeing kind of the end of it in the 80s. I think there's like one or two universities in the country that still do have something like a parapsychology department, but there used to be parapsychology departments. And for those who don't know, parapsychology is just a fancy way of saying studying the paranormal. So it's like in Ghostbusters, you know, where they're at a college at the beginning. So you're like studying telepathy, precognition, ghosts, psychokinesis, apparitions, you know, the whole nine yards. And if we're going to the standard of you don't actually have to produce results and you just have to talk about, you know, the meta, it's like YouTube essays where you have a 5-hour essay but isn't actually directly on the thing. It's about the meta analysis of the thing. I know that's actually a term that actually applies to the scientific field and research.
Yeah.
But it's like if we're going to that standard, I feel like parapsychology, they should have held out a little longer. If they only held out 20 more years, they'd be in the golden age. They'd be making money hand over fist, but it didn't hold out. It just didn't hold out.
We would need to, you know, don't worry about quantitative evidence for ghosts. Just, we'll talk about people's lived experience.
That's right.
With ghosts.
It's perfect. That's like the ultimate lived experience. Like, how are you going to disprove it?
Or unlived experience, as the case might be. But that's what we're doing, right? This is another way of knowing. Well, this kind of stuff, another way of, you know, whatever the hell it is. And I understand that, like, American Indians, and I use that term, by the way, purposely, because research studies show that that's still the most popular term among that group of people, other than they really just prefer to be called by their tribe, right? You know, but... You know, so I use that term respectfully. And I know they've been through a lot. Many Native Americans have reservations to live in poverty. You know, there are real concerns that we should be compassionate about, that we should try to help these folks out in any way that we can. So I'm very, I actually love Native American history, you know, the history of the North American tribes. I'm really fascinated by the stuff. They're really remarkable cultures. The Iroquois, the Comanche, the Sioux were like almost like Sparta. You know, they had these empires that, you know, by the way, we're colonial. They were colonizing empires, you know, slave owning, genocidal empire. But they're cool history, you know. And it's not because I approve of all these things, right? But they're interesting. But anyway, point being is like all this is fascinating, and people should learn about these cultures, and people should respect people, you know, who are Native American or American Indian, you know. But then we're getting to like there was something in Canada recently from some organization that was talking about like Turtle Island and like treating it as if it's like a serious thing, that the idea that we all it's actually a new term, but it's sort of like an amalgam of like different Native American beliefs about like it's creationism, right? Basically the idea that there's like we all live on Turtle Island, that kind of stuff. And you can be respectful of those beliefs just the way that you're respectful of like a Baptist who believes the earth is 8,000 years old, or, you know, someone else who, you know, who's, you know, essentially a creation. We, you know, be respectful of those people's views. You have the right to believe that stuff, but we shouldn't teach it at university as if it's true. Indigenous, you know, knowledge about history or indigenous knowledge about medicine. I mean, people died young. Modern medicine is just better. I mean, it's got weaknesses. I'm not going to say it's, you know, perfect by any means, but, you know, this idea that to be respectful of these cultures, that we have to treat their knowledge as if it's the same thing as science is, you know, really kind of silly. It's like, I don't expect people to treat like ancient Celtic knowledge, which is my background, as if it, you know, was true. It wasn't. And so again, I'm not disrespecting these people, but universities have lost their minds. You know, they're trying to be nice, I guess, but they're being patronizing, you know.
It's not of any value to them. That's the craziest thing. You know, you see this all the time. The people who are most into the DEI stuff, what do they tend to be? Do they tend to be indigenous sometimes, or Hispanic or Native American? sometimes. Usually they tend to be white. Usually they're women. And if you look at the class background, it's like most of them, their families are making, you know, double the average salary. And I'm not, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. But it is, but it comes with certain class expectations, and that's kind of what the it seems like the institutions are wanting to reinforce. But that's of no value, like the Native Americans. You know, this has frustrated me to pieces because part of my mission, I served a lot of it with people who were Lakota Sioux, and that and the terrible poverty that I got to witness really still bothers me to this day. You know, there are real problems, and they just aren't being dealt with. But it seems like to me, it's like all ideas are valid except the true ones and the really hard ones. But that doesn't benefit anyone. It only benefits the people who are already comfortable. You know, it's like what they say about journalism, you know, to afflict the comfortable. You know, it's not afflicting the comfortable. It's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
But for some reason, if you say this stuff, you're immediately put on one side of the aisle. You obviously vote a certain way. You're obviously a certain kind of person. I keep hoping things will change, but this kind of stuff just keeps getting reinforced. And the sad thing is that there are things these institutions are supposed to cover. You know, you brought up the Native American issue. You know, in the U.S., there are parts of the country for Native Americans where, you know, they're living at third world standards. Life expectancy is much lower. They have a much lower income. They have a much lower positive future, and it's frustrating. And I know I'm kind of harping on too much on this because I think we've basically covered it, but people just don't want to be adults anymore, and that does come with a cost. And the thing is, as anyone that's ever had kids or dealt with kids, you know, they pick up what the adults around them are doing. And this kind of stuff, you know, so many people have problems with Gen Z, but how much of that is because they were just paying attention or doing what their parents, the generations before, were doing. I would end this part though, and I would move to a positive, that we can have this conversation, that there are more people who are aware. While people may not be doing anything, the people who are in charge of Harvard or Yale aren't doing anything. There is interest, and I think that there's interest. I think that there are people like yourself, like Wilfred Riley, people who are in academia who. And there seems to be more of you guys all the time. I mean, it's still slow. It's drips and drabs, but it is growing. That kind of stuff does give me hope. But I don't know if that means we lead to a future where there's a better tolerance for free speech and there's more people who are demanding results and honest analysis, or if it's just going to be this truncated thing where you have the majority institutions are controlled by, you know, the people who are in charge right now, and then there's like this minority of institutions, and maybe that would be the best outcome, but I'm not certain. I appreciate you coming on, Chris. I know this isn't like a super happy thing, and you have put a lot. You know, I've always respected you and your work as a speaker, as a writer, as a scientist. You've always been honest up front, and you generally haven't been trying to just tell people what they want to hear. I think that is so very important. And just speaking from my own perspective, working in news, it is rare. I don't know why we seem to live in this moment. This is how it is, but that seems to be what's going on. And maybe there's a connection there. Maybe it's because we live in the most comfortable moment, you know, medicine, economy, convenience of technology, and maybe that has something to do with it. I'm not sure. But it does leave me depressed. It leaves a lot of people depressed. And I'm just going to probably end this program with everyone sad and mopey because we're all doomed. It's all over. Might as well roll over, give it to the Chinese. So then we can watch.
I'm a little bit more optimistic. I mean, nothing's forever, right? And everything kind of goes in cycles. And yeah, I'll say this. I'm talking to my own lived experience, Dad. I made fun of the lived experience, you know, but. Yeah, everybody's always worried about Gen Z, right? You know, mm-hmm. You see all these surveys that come out that Gen Z has these very authoritarian, you know, attitudes. And again, you know, Gen Z was kind of made to look bad over the last month with the anti-Semitism and all that. But, you know, my experience, though, with students, you know, working in the university is largely positive. And, you know, I think the problem, you know, that the students have is not that they're hyper authoritarian or hyper woke, to use that word again necessarily, but they're just repeating what they've heard. And mostly it's kind of like education. So if you tell them, they show up and they think like, you know, that Native Americans lived in like these communes where they held hands and worshipped, you know, trans individuals, you know.
Oh, dude, this is something that was I was starting to see even when I was on my mission exactly a decade ago, by the way. That'll be 10 years from that, where you'll hear this all the time if you're on Twitter. You know, the two-spirit idea. Oh, Native Americans, they've always, you know, Native Americans, obviously, they're just all one big thing. They're just all one giant thing. They all had this two-spirit thing going way, way back. And it's like, have you actually spent any time with people who identify as Native American? It's like, no, that is not a thing. If you were to go to the Sioux Rez, Lakota Rez out here, so you're going to Rosebud or Pine Ridge, and you were saying, oh, and I'm two-spirit. I mean, that's a good way to get yourself killed on those reservations. I mean, that's not a fun, happy idea that celebrate. That's like, what is kind of wrong with you, weirdo? And it's like, that isn't reflective of the Native American experience at all, but that's so many people. You know, it's like the top guy on Twitter for Lakota Sioux is this guy called Lakota Man, and he's a white guy. He's never been on reservation. It's been broken several times. But people just keep going back to that. I know that was a tangent, but it's just one of those things. It just rubs me the wrong way.
Well, I tell my students, just for fun, next time you have a chance to go to a Native American reservation or whatever, you talk to your tour guide, whoever's chaperoning you around or whatever, ask them, hey, can I talk to, who's your leading two-spirit person? And just like, see the blank stare.
No, it's crazy. It's like, it's so bizarre because the people who say they represent these groups probably have had the least amount of time with them. It's like the issue of, my brother, oddly enough, he also served on reservation, but he served down in Arizona. And one common thing you see on the reservation, it's funny because you see these very environmental groups always strongly associating themselves with the tribes. And it's like animal rights, taking care of animals, not a high priority on the res, unfortunately. I think the saddest thing I saw one time was you're driving through after picking up my brother. So we stopped. We were in reservation territory in Arizona. So we stopped the gas station. And as we were waiting, I was waiting in the car. I watched this guy come in, this old guy come in. He has a res dog with him, which is basically, it's just a mutt. That's how it goes. He gets to the car. The dog's hanging around. It's his dog. The dog is happy. He goes and does his stuff. The dog is kind of walks around smelling. He gets to the truck. He knows the dog is there. He just drives off. And then I watch this dog for half an hour walk around the gas station, try to talk to people, figure out what the heck just happened. And this, to me, it was a huge animal lover. I have a dog sitting on my lap right here.
Yeah.
It was demonstrous. I was like, that terrible, terrible guy. But John's like, Peter, you know how it is. That isn't the abnormal. That's the standard over here.
It's just
we're so disconnected from reality. It's funny, but it's also pretty sad.
I mean, the good news, this is my optimism side of this, is if you tell students this, 95% of them are fine with it. They're not attached to these ideas. I mean, you can tell students, slavery in the U.S. was bad, but did you know that North Africans, took nearly 2 million slaves out of Europe at about the same time? It doesn't excuse what we did to Africa, and of course, the African slaves were first kidnapped by Africans too, so there was, whites were enslaved, in North Africa, and most of them died. There's no white, diaspora in Africa. They just vanished from history, and most of them. History is complicated, right? And people are just kind of crappy everywhere. But and students, if you tell them this, they're okay with it. They absorb it, and they're like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So the students aren't as radical. The median student, at least, is not as radical as I think people are worried. But they just don't get told these things. Nobody tells them that Native Americans engaged in genocidal wars against other Native Americans before Europeans ever showed up, or that, the Ottoman Empire, had a massive slave, market that was running people from all over the world through it, or that the worst genocides in history took place in China, and it was just China versus other Chinese, for the most part, or that it was a Central Asian who has the world record for killing off the most people per capita you know, Tamerlane, right? You know, in the world at the time. Yeah, you know? But you tell people this, and then they go, okay, yeah, I get it. Like, human behavior is kind of complicated, you know, and there's a lot of bad stuff. And then they're able to, you know, they don't get mad. They don't like try to cancel you. Maybe one out of, you know, 50 do, but, you know, most of the students are, you know, or even, and it's a matter of faith themselves, are Native American or Black or Asian or trans. And you can kind of talk about the complexities of trans issues, and most trans students are fine with it. You know, it's just, we're all, you know, sort of, I don't know, hostages of that 5% who have really radical ideas. But my hope for the future is that, you know, most Gen Zers, when you give them good information, will adjust to it, and they're not upset by it, you know. And the problem I think we have right now is we're just not giving them that kind of well-rounded education. We're not teaching them civics. We're not teaching them history very effectively. So I think the fix is easy. We just need to, but you know, in the sense of easy, in the sense of, we just need to change the educational system. Now that's not easy, but I think that's the problem with a lot of what's happening today. Is just K through 12, and then universities all have these really big problems with how we're teaching our kids today, and we just need to figure out how to fix that.
You make two good points in there that I do agree with. The first is that it doesn't take a lot of responsibility for a lot of positive change. You just need that one good teacher. You just need people to just try a little more, and that can make a huge difference. That is the advantage when you're at rock bottom. Even a small increase, you know, if you're at one and you go to two, you just doubled.
Yeah. So,
that is one of the positives. The other thing is, like, and you bring up a good point, you know, most of the people are in for this. It's a lot of Gen Z has surprisingly kind of like Gen X in the sense that they're kind of very sarcastic about how things are. But the problem is you have that 1 in 50, but that 1 in 50 can get someone fired. That 1 in 50 can, you know, get another kid kicked out of school. I don't know if I shared this story on the podcast before, but I had a friend of someone I talked to, they were taking medical school, and they're a member of my church. So Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormon, what have you. And they were at medical school, and they're a pretty good student, but they're a bit too inquisitive, and they were a bit too, they were kind of like James Damore in the sense that when they say, oh, you know, we want to hear your opinion, they actually believed it. Anyhow, so the student is in medical school, and apparently during one of the classes, a student and then one of the visiting teachers, so wasn't a regular, had got very upset that they felt that he was being rude and dismissive. And not that he had said or done anything necessarily bad, from what I can tell. Maybe it was just like body language, or they didn't really like him. Humans are like this. They don't necessarily always even need a reason to pick out someone from the herd. And so he gets called, and it becomes this big thing. So he's brought to the dean of the medical school, talks to the dean of medical school, first time this happens. I got your back. You're right. This is all so silly. It's all being ridiculous. You know, you just need to focus on trying to get through and keep doing your best. You know, you could do it, buddy. And then he goes away. Unfortunately, as these things happen, they don't tend to be let go of. You know, whoever felt what they were the agreed party to start this thing off, they don't tend to let go. So this happens again. He gets brought in a second time. And this time, the dean, who is also, by the way, a member of my church, which I know that shouldn't be favoritism, but, you know, sometimes it helps. In this situation, the second time, where it's clear that this might actually hurt the medical school dean, totally different outcome. It was, you just need to be quiet, and, you know, you need to stop causing trouble. And it's the same guy, and it's not like anything's changed, but what has changed is now is that maybe his job is on the line, or something that might impact him. And then he washes his hand of this kid. And the kid, the person I'm talking to, this is deeply unfair, like he's been treated this way. I agree. But this is just how humans are. And you only need that one person. You only need that one Karen. And it causes so much trouble. I don't know what the Karen version of is a guy. Is that, no, that's not Chad. Whatever that is.
Yeah, incel thing, yeah.
Yeah, Kevin. I don't know. But until that changes, though, I think we may be in a pain spot for a while to come. But we'll have to see. You've brought in some really good points today, Chris. I think you moved me a little farther away from the edge, jumping off the ledge here. I mean, and there are lots of good things, right? I mean, the world of books is fantastic. The world of alternative journalism is fantastic. YouTube shows like this. So, I mean, it's not all bad, but it's definitely tough. Is there anything else, you know? You here, we'll stop here. tell me, well, Chris, what is the positives? What can you tell us that will give us hope, that will put wind beneath our wings like the soaring eagle, so that we don't leave this episode so despondent?
Well, first off, things are better in 2023 than they were in 2020, very clearly, I think. You know, they're still worse than they were in 2013, but they're better than they were in 2020. So I think we're moving in a positive direction. More people are speaking out, and people are voting with their dollars with some of the stuff, you know, and that's what's going to matter to a large degree. So audiences are finding their voice as well in terms of what movies or books they want to support, which ones they don't. J.K. Rowling is still a multi-billionaire, so that means something. And Halloween, you know, we get like 500 kids. Like, I'm not kidding, 500 kids at our house. There are plenty of Harry Potter costumes still. So, you know, with all that stuff going on with her, she's doing fine, you know. So I think in general, people are getting tired of that sort of moral policing all the time. And I can tell you, this is probably the positive thing, the Gen Zers are sick of it too, you know, that, yeah, yes, they are more liberal than past generations. They believe in things like universal healthcare or whatever else, but they're tired of being, they're the ones that are being policed more than everybody else by their peers, you know, and they hate it, you know, and so they're getting super tired of it as well. So I don't think that we have a huge cohort of authoritarians who are rising up, you know, in the new generation. We right now have a small number of authoritarians who are very loud and very powerful, as you mentioned. And what we need to do is figure out how to give that group of people less power than what they've got right now. But I am optimistic that the next generation, the Gen Zers, are not actually going to break the world.
Okay. World will survive. Thank you so much, Chris, for coming on. Chris Ferguson is a fantastic writer, scientist, researcher. He's a regular contributor for Psychology Today. You can find him also on his Substack, which is, what is your Substack? It's like Manor Grimoire, or do I have that backwards?
If you just look at Secrets of Grimoire Manor on Substack, I think it's like, yeah, substack.grimoire.com or something like that, but it's Secrets of Grimoire Manor on Substack, and you'll be able to find it.
Okay, and he's also on Twitter. Chris is awesome. Anything I've read him do or watched him on, he's usually great. I usually learn something. So I appreciate him taking the time to come on. I know this conversation was a little wobbly, but he's getting over bronchitis. I am just kind of feeling, I don't know, a little dampened in the mood today, a little despondent. So I appreciate Chris talking me away from the ledge. I think we're going to end it here, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch Culturescape. Thank you again to Bain Books Publishing and Young Voices for helping put this together and supporting the program. Thank you, of course, to my editor, Chris Holowicki. I have no idea how he's going to edit all this. Chris is a gem and a master of the video editing arts, and we thank him once again. And to all of you, listeners, audience, viewers, thank you. I hope you learned something here today. I know I sure did. And I guess we're going to cut it here. Until next time, my friends, keep geeking out.